Okay, hi everybody, and welcome to episode 118 of the Alexis L podcast. We are in week two, I guess, of the US and Israeli illegal strikes on Iran, and also, of course,
southern Lebanon,
the Bekaa Valley, and parts of Crystal Palace. Interesting developments. I mean, I think it's really interesting. I mean, it's really interesting, I think, how this war has gone. And I also think it really highlights how, even more than the Israeli genocide in a way, how our media are self-censoring. So from the websites or the podcasts or whatever, the videos that I have looked at of people I trust, and particularly Richard Medhurst at Electronic Intifada, and but also John Mearsheimer, Professor John Mearsheimer at the University of Chicago, also talking to Chris Hedges. The situation, it seems to me, which is completely underreported in, or not completely not reported in the Western media, is that the Iranians have taken out all of, and this is what Richard Medhurst certainly said, have taken out all of the US forward radar stations in the Gulf countries. So these are radar stations that essentially are the front line of Israel's Iron Dome defenses. And it just, you know, the way that these bought and paid for, these analysts that they have on the BBC and Sky, just are not, not reporting the situation. So this is my understanding. The Iranians have taken out all these forward radar bases. So the Iron Dome, obviously the Iron Dome is also, they're using $500,000 missiles to shoot down $20,000 drones, and their stocks are being rapidly deported. And there's genuinely true that the United States is shifting THAADs, air defense missile systems, from South Korea. They're shifting them by C-17 Galaxies, by aircraft, from South Korea to the Middle East to protect Israel. Iran is, and lots of people warned that this would happen, that Iran is using low cost missiles, low cost drones, to financially and materially deplete the air defenses of Israel, of the Gulf Emirates, and of the United States forces, and that they are being rapidly depleted, and they've also blinded the eyes and ears. I know that also what's not been reported is that there's a massive clampdown in Israel on anybody who shows any imagery of damage. I think will be arrested and could be sentenced up to 5 years in one of Israel's lovely prisons, which I'm sure are bad even for Israelis. Believable reports that the damage in Israel itself is massive and likely to get bigger. There was a rumor went around, I think, that wasn't true, that Netanyahu's brother had been killed, and Smotrich, where'd you go with the evil upper echelons of the Israeli state? But Smotrich, one of the two far right ministers, his son had been killed. And it's certainly true that his son has been quite gravely injured. The Israelis, as they have done it and did in Gaza, are underreporting massively the deaths of their forces, I think. And so, I don't know whether you could say that Iran is actually winning this war, but it's certainly staying in the fight. And that, this involves, it's not without cost, that involves massive suffering for the Iranian people and Iranian infrastructure, but that they have thought long and hard about how to resist this in what they believe, I think, thought was probably an inevitability, which is an attack on Iran by Israel and the United States. And they've got multiple levels of kind of autonomous command. So
yeah,
you kill as many levels of leadership as you want, but they're still able to fire missiles and also mine the Strait of Hormuz, you know, at a kind of a local level, that there are independent commanders, you know, not undetectable, I think, also to Israeli surveillance, who can do this, really. So it's, you know, week two, it's horrific. But in a way, I mean, I saw somewhere in a way, was it in the, I can't remember where it was, but somebody writing that in a way, I mean, again, you sometimes get, you know, you see in the comments people, you know, if you criticize the regime in Iran, you know, you are aiding genocide or whatever. I mean, one cannot support the regime in Iran. You know, say they are right wing in themselves, right wing theocratic regime. You know, who murdered, you know, communists and socialists in huge numbers after the revolution of 79. But on the other hand, they have thought about this, and they are, in a way, if they can defeat this onslaught, they're doing. I heard that fucking stupid fucking arsehole spokesman for Israel, former head of Labour Friends of Israel, David Mentzer, who's a cretin of gigantic proportion, looks like it as well. Mm-hmm. Sometimes some of these people don't look. He looks like a fucking arsehole.
Yeah.
And he is, and stupid and arrogant and an idiot. But him saying, I'd say at the end of some interview on Radio 4 with him saying, you know, we're doing this, Israel's doing this for Western civilization, you know. No. Iran is doing this for Western civilization. If at this point they can turn back the AI-aided international rules-destroying force of Israel and the United States, making them think again after their successes in what they think are their successes in Gaza and the West Bank and southern Lebanon, if Iran can make them think again by using asymmetrical warfare, then Iran is doing a favor for all of us in the Western democracies, and inverted commas.
That's and set so, a new precedent,
you know,
really.
Yeah, and it is. You know, it's so. Yeah, so I mean, that's my analysis of other people's analysis. This obviously went in. I think that Trump was probably. Well, Trump was argued into it by Netanyahu, and who I suspect knows how to manipulate him.
Yeah.
And also the hundreds of million dollars that he's been given by pro-Israel fanatics like Miriam Adelson, you know, and also this is, you know, that I think the Trump family now has extensive business dealings in Israel. So he's been bribed to do this, but he's also been kind of smooth talked into it. And I wonder if he's feeling resentful now because. Netanyahu, he has not been delivered the swift victory that he thought he was going to get. Only 20% of the United States population are for it. I mean, the figures must be much lower here, I imagine, for old Starmer's fucking grotesque posturing. And so, you know, the war goes on, really, and
Starmer hasn't folded as you might have expected him to the degree, right, that you might have expected him to.
Hasn't he? Well, I mean, he hasn't joined in the war, you mean?
Yeah.
He's letting them use the air bases, though.
He did fold on that, didn't he? At first he said he wouldn't, and then he backtracked, as you would expect from Starmer.
Yeah, but it's also this, you know, Sarah Sackman, for instance, the pro-Israel fanatic who did a lot of illegal training in Israel, who is now our courts minister and has just been instrumental in banning the Al-Quds march. How somebody can, you know, somebody explain to me how this devotion to another country that isn't your country, how that is not treason, really. Like the 2,000 men, mostly men, I think, in British men who have fought, who have been in, in part of the genocide in the last 3 years. Yeah. How fighting for in the army of a foreign government isn't treason. And like I saw Lindsey Graham, the Republican senator, saying, you know, he's all in for Israel. Israel is his number one. That's treason. Isn't that treason? You know, explain to me how that isn't treason. So I forgot what I was talking about. Well, apart from the, you know, those vile pro-Israel supporters. You know, and if you support Israel, you support genocide, you support ethnic cleansing, you support apartheid.
You were talking about the approval rating in the US.
Oh, yeah, so the approval rating. I mean, even though the Starmer government still trying to be kind of reform, a pound shop, reform, you know, is striking these belligerent kind of militaristic posturing. And yeah, that's right. Sarah Sackman refused to condemn. She said, you know, the killing of the murder of the girls in the girls' school in Madib, but that was just, you know, some shit that happens. But she condemned Iranian attacks on civilians. And that, it's just extraordinary hypocrisy. Just breathtaking, I think.
So it is, it's weird that so if the mainstream news isn't covering the damage that Iran is doing to Israel and to, you know, American bases around the region and stuff, if they're not covering that to a full extent, then surely that would just garner more sympathy for Iran. If you're just, all you're showing is,
I guess,
showing the public is the bombardment of Tehran and Iran, Iranian land.
I don't know. I mean, it's just kind of, it's militaristic kind of glorification, isn't it? To say, look at the mighty power of the West. But also they're saying, oh, yeah, the number of missiles has reduced. You know, I mean, clearly the Iranians still have a huge stockpile of missiles and are using them, you know, deploying them. And they also, I think they haven't started yet using their hypersonic missiles. And my understanding is the Khurram Shah 4 is unshootable down even by something like a THAAD system. It can't be shot down even by Iron Dome or David Zarrow or whatever.
Jesus.
Whatever fucking term they use.
Yeah, they've been saving the good stuff.
And those things are then going to be directed towards Israel and will cause tremendous destruction. That is my understanding. I think my understanding of the Iranian strategy.
Iran has had decades to think about and plan what they would do under these circumstances. And you can't imagine Israel and America really planning that far ahead. Anything we fucking do.
No, this is, well, the Israelis do. I mean, all the Israelis want to do is what they call the Dahiya doctrine after the southern Beirut suburbs, which is the power base of Hezbollah, that they just want to do what they did in Gaza, really, which is just flatten it and either kill or completely destroy the support base for Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. And they don't bomb
residential buildings in Beirut then in central Beirut.
I think sometimes there's some Iranians there, sometimes there isn't, I think. But it's just a general murderousness. They just want to destroy anybody who can stand up to them, really. And they don't care if they kill children. They don't care if they kill women. They don't care if they kill civilians. They are. In fact, they intentionally, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah,
they're the ones with the stockpiles of actual nukes.
I mean,
not
that's the other question.
Not ability to create nukes, stockpiles of hundreds of them.
Yep.
And I worry about, you know, what they would do in their death flails.
Again, I saw another, expert on Sky saying, you know, what about nuclear weapons? Oh, no, the Americans are, you know, use nuclear weapons, not acknowledging that Israel has nuclear weapons and that those nutters are much more likely to use them. Yes, I think it's a real possibility.
And yes, it is possible to recognize and be horrified by the illegal bombardment and war on Iran, whilst at the same time recognizing the horror, the bad side of the Iranian regime, and absolutely, that they're not fucking lovely, cuddly teddy bears. They've been bad to their people, and they will continue to do so. But
any
war is unnecessary and illegal, especially this one. I mean, and they were fucking provoked first. So, like, it is possible if you have more than two brain cells to hold both thoughts in your head. Like, you can hate the Assad regime and hate the current, you know, fanatics that are running Syria at the same time.
Exactly.
And like, that's, you can know that in your head, UAE and these Gulf states deserve not to feel like they're the safe zone in the Middle East. And while at the same time recognizing that there are victims, you know, everyday people everywhere, you know, you should be able to maintain these thoughts in your head. Like, some of the comments we get on the YouTube. Fucking shocking, man. Well, find myself debating these people and then deleting my comments because I shouldn't. This is where I get to talk, and they can talk in the comments as much as they want, but fucking hell.
Yeah.
And
it's a depressing aspect of human nature, that kind of behavior, isn't it? That kind of Manichaean splitting of the world into good and evil, really. So.
Yeah. And also, let me just say one thing to some of those keyboard warriors out there. I'm Syrian. I'm allowed to have my opinions on Syria. And you can't really come at me for that. I'm allowed to have my fucking opinions.
Yeah. And I'm not grateful because you take a lot of the-
Yeah.
You take a lot of the heat from me, really. They hate you more than they hate me.
And what I say here, I'm not writing down in a book. I'm just spitballing with Alexi. I'm allowed to share my thoughts.
Yeah, you're
telling me that I shouldn't talk. Fuck off.
Yeah.
Although this is the Alexi Sale podcast, not the Alexi and Talal.
Absolutely. Well, I'm grateful to you for taking those digital bullets for me. You're flinging your body into
my path. My honor and my duty, comrade. We have to protect the spokesperson of the movement.
Thank you. So I guess, that's our report from week two of the Iran-Israel-US war. Interesting development today, I think. There is to talk about censorship, there is a guy called Rafi Berg, who is the BBC's, he was in charge of the Middle East content for the BBC. He's a kind of gatekeeper through whom all Middle East comment goes, I understand it. Now, Owen Jones wrote about this and said that, that Berg was the reason why the coverage on the BBC of the Israeli genocide had been so poor, had been so one-sided, i.e. not acknowledging Israel's genocidal behavior, war crimes. And Rafi Berg then sued Owen Jones for libel, which is very unusual for a journalist to sue another journalist for libel. In fact, the last time it was done was John Ware, who did that highly partial, I think, is Labour anti-Semitic Panorama documentary just before the 2019 general election. And very, very, with some very distorted contributions, I think. And he sued Paddy French, and French lost not to pay £90,000 damages. I don't think that would happen now in the changed climate.
Should I read you a bit of this article on it?
Yeah, go ahead.
Owen Jones claims victory in key part of BBC libel case over Gaza. This is from The National, Scotland's The National. Is that a creditable?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know.
Publication. BBC Middle East editor Rafi Berg sued Owen Jones, a columnist for The National and The Guardian, for libel over an article in which he accused the broadcaster of being biased against Palestinians in their coverage of the Gaza genocide. Berg has pledged to continue his case after the High Court made an interim ruling which supported Jones's argument that the allegations of bias were a statement of opinion. Okay, they didn't side with him and say he was right, but they said he's allowed his opinion. In a statement after the High Court ruling, Owen Jones tweeted, "I am delighted that the High Court has ruled in my favor on the key issues in the libel case brought forward by Rafi Berg. The court rejected the claimant's interpretation of the article and ruled that it expressed an opinion based on stated material. I stand by my journalism, and if Mr. Berg decides to continue the libel claim, I look forward to defending my article in court. In the piece, Jones reported that BBC staff had told him Berg plays a key role in a wider BBC culture of systemic Israeli propaganda. The editor reshapes everything from headlines to story text to images, and repeatedly seeks to foreground the Israeli military perspective. So is this when you keep seeing these posts about how the language, just little details, but has this subconscious...
Yeah.
It's like Israeli soldiers are killed, whereas Palestinian children die.
Yes.
You know, as if by this mysterious power that no one can understand. They just die. Yeah. Whereas one Israeli soldier killed, 400 children died. Which has this...
subconscious effect.
To the layman, I suppose, you know, the layperson who's not invested in this as many of us are, they just see those words and it soaks in. And
people just read the headlines often. Yeah. Yes, and well, Owen Jones says that it's down to Rafi Berg, and who are we to... I note that Rafi Berg is being he's used as his solicitor, Mark Lewis of Patreon Law. Mark Lewis is a founder of UK Lawyers for Israel, is a pro-Israel fanatic himself, therefore is a fanatic for, if you're a fanatic for Israel, you're a fanatic for genocide, ethnic cleansing and apartheid. And he is also, he's a brother of Martin Lewis, of course, the money-saving expert, but he is also the one who stood up and complained that Reg Hunter gig.
Reginald D. Hunter.
And sued Reg for libel. I think it was for libel, along with the campaign against anti-Semitism. You can get me the details of that case.
Dragged poor Reg through,
as they say, the process is the punishment. I think poor Reg was dragged through years of, and but the judges. Summation. Can you get that up? The judges, what the judge said when he threw out the case about the campaign against anti-Semitism and.
Yep. The judge Michael Snow ruled that the CAA, campaign against anti-Semitism, was seeking to use the criminal justice system for improper reasons. The CAA have demonstrated by the misleading and partial way in which it summarized its application and its willful repeated failure to meet its disclosure obligations, that its true and sole motive in seeking to prosecute Reginald Hunter is to have him cancelled. I have no doubt that the prosecution, I'll do my judge voice, that the prosecution is abusive, Judge Snow added.
Yeah, I mean, that should have been headline fucking news around Britain, but it was really buried. I think only The Guardian briefly covered. But that is such a swinging condemnation.
That was a fair play. That was a BBC headline. Right. Judge quashes anti-Semitism case. Right. Yep. Our lawyers. Yeah. They fucking wasted everyone's time with that. And yeah, Mark Lewis said about the Rafi Berg situation, he said the judgment is an interim finding rather than a final determination, which is true. Instead of posting on social media, poking a barb there at Owen Jones, we will continue to proceed through the court. So they're not going to back down, according to Mr. Lewis.
No, well, again, they try and make it, even if, you know, they have extensive funds, obviously, and they just tie you up in this shit for years. And even if they lose, like poor Reg, they really make your life a misery, really. And it's vexatious, I think. I think going
that's the big tool these guys have, man, you know.
Yeah.
I have a good friend who has a YouTube channel about conspiracy theories, and he basically just points out how silly they are, and these people who promote them, you know, flat earthers and people think that ULEZ cameras have fucking cancer radars in them and stuff like that. I don't know.
Yeah.
And he constantly is fighting against their attacks. And, you know, when we have shows together, if they find out, they call in bomb threats. Like, we've had to cancel shows because of bomb
threats. This is the Israel lobby.
No, this is, no, this is, no, this is just like
conspiracy nuts.
Conspiracy nuts.
Right.
But, you know, there is an overlap. And, you know, that, but, and now he's tied up in this massive court case, which is so clearly a massive waste of everyone's time. But
yeah,
it just, it is such a hindrance to him, my friend.
Yeah.
And it's causing him such anxiety and stress. You know, yeah, that's the punishment alone. That's the damage. Doesn't really matter what the court says in the end.
Yeah.
Plus, if you're famous, you get the headlines and stuff. That will besmirch your reputation.
Yeah. Well, Mark Lewis is, I mean, Mark Lewis was also in, involved in the Peter Newborn case, that the academic who was in Labour against anti-Semitism, a particularly crazy bunch of mostly non-Jews, particularly demented bunch. Paul Holden writes very well about them in The Fraud, but and Newborn actually killed himself in the end. But partly, but I get him. I mean, I think that other people had been encouraging him to go on with his. He was trying to sue Michael Rosen, I think, and in the end, and the only, but it was somebody saying the only, oddly, the only person, he was being egged on by all these Zionists. The only person who actually kind of took any care of him, who was worried about Professor Newborn, was Michael Rosen himself, the man who Newborn was trying to sue. It was over this, Newborn had altered this Michael Rosen book, you know, Jeremy Reading, you know, We're Going on a Jew Hunt, that one.
Right.
Look it up. It was a scandal. Anyway, but it was, poor Michael Rosen was worried about Newborn, and was the those horrible fucking like what Tracy Ann Oberman and Rachel Riley and that crowd instituted a Peter Newborn annual award for fighting against anti-Semitism. I don't know exactly what it's called, but I know it's named after Peter Newborn. And Newborn's widow pleaded with them not to do it, but they, you know, they don't listen. Then they don't, you know, anybody, they will sacrifice anybody for their evil cause.
Well, yes, that is their tactic. They are dastardly and devious folks. And, you know, they, you know, I can't decide if also if Israel wants to destroy Arabs or steal all their steal all their culture and food. I went viral the yesterday.
Oh yeah,
Which is a story I wanted to tell you.
Go on.
So I was in central London on 2 days ago, doing a job, a little mini job, and you know the Oxford Circus. Exit to the tube station where there's a little road that leads down to Carnaby Street. And there's that place Wok to Walk there, that noodle bar. And next to it, there's a new place called Zaman Shawarma. And it was brand new, sparkling. And they've got this chicken shawarma and, you know, little shawarma joint. And they had some social media people doing some promotional filming out the front. And I'm like, cool, shawarma in the heart of London, like right in Oxford Circus. And I went up to one of the staff and I noticed none of the staff looked Arabic to me. They were all South Asian. And I asked him, hey, man, have you got Arabic owners for this place? And I was wearing my red kufiya. At the time, I said, yeah, has this place got Arabic owners? And he said, oh, they're Mediterranean.
Yeah, that Mediterranean does a lot of heavy lifting these days, doesn't it? Yeah.
I said, where are they from? He said, oh, the owner is Israeli. And I scoffed the scoffiest scoff right in this guy's face and walked away. I didn't say another word. And then later on my way back, I went and did my job. And an hour later, I was coming back to the station and I thought, fuck it. I want to warn people about the place because, you know, I don't want people to get tricked. This is, you know, often you'll think something is Arabic or, and it's, there's a deviousness there. So I filmed a little video of my face and the restaurant, or it's not even a restaurant, it's a takeaway, behind me. I just made a video telling that exact story of my interaction with that man. And I said, Zaman is an Arabic word. And shawarma is an Arabic word and Arabic food. They haven't spelt pita right. You can order a pita and they have one T in the word pita, right, as opposed to pitta, as it's supposed to be written. So I said, just avoid this place, boycott. And I might have wrongly accused the next door place, Wok to Walk, which is actually quite a tasty noodle bar. I wrongly accused it of probably being under the same ownership, which I corrected in the caption under the video, because they're actually Japanese and Dutch owned. A big up Wok to Walk. Sorry for besmirching you. But yeah, I've just posted that video up. I said, they're stealing our food, our language, our culture right here on Oxford Circus. Avoid this place, boycott. And I posted it. I don't have many followers. I have about 4,000 followers on Instagram. Cut to yesterday, I realized, oh shit, this is getting shared. Loads. The video now has like 830 shares, 830 reposts, over 2,600 shares on people's stories and shit. And the video now has 73,000 views, which is shocking to me. I'm very proud of it, though. Like, good. I'm glad that people obviously value this information. Because God knows, I post so many like clips on my Instagram, funny clips and little jokes and stuff, and no one gives a shit about that. I promote my gigs on there, but I post this one thing that is actually like informative pro-Palestine content, and it's just blown up over 70,000 views. I've never had anything like that in one day. And then yesterday I had this commercial casting. I went for an audition and I'm starting to think, shit, what do I do? It's right there on my page and it's the first post, and should I hide it for a few days? Like, and now I'm having these thoughts because I'm worried that I might not get a job that I really need, you know, because they see that on my, these, you get all these fucking complex thoughts worrying about work and stuff just because you're sharing your views. And but that's wild. So if you're ever in central London, don't eat at Zaman. It's not genuine shawarma. It's an Israeli. Yeah, it's Mediterranean. That is a big warning. When they say Mediterranean food. But it's a strange feeling to have that many eyes on you in such a short time. I feel exposed a little bit. But yeah, good on you guys. And someone very interesting followed me because of it, and I'm going to try and get him on the show. I think you'll like him.
Okay.
Yeah. Little change of subject here. We posted on the Patreon the second edition of Alexi Reacts.
Yes.
This week you reacted to
Motorbike Routine from what we think is stuff.
Probably stuff, maybe all new, but there it is. You're doing stand-up about the motorbikers. And very nice little video. You quite enjoy doing those,
I did enjoy it tremendously, yeah.
What should we react to next, folks? Have your say. Head to patreon.com/AlexiSaleSpodcast. Support the show. Chuck us a couple quid every month. It goes a long way to keep the show going and keeping us in business. And you get to watch Alexi Reacts every week. What should he react to next? Please drop us a line. Drop me a message on the Patreon. Email alexisalepodcast@gmail.com. But most importantly, go to patreon.com/AlexiSalePodcast. I have a question for you from the Patreon.
Oh, right, yeah. That's how we fill the time. I'd forgotten. Yeah.
From Nipless Cage. Okay. Nippleless.
Real name. Yeah.
Nippleless Cage. There is a Radio 4 program called The Real Comedy Controllers, The Things That Made Us Laugh, with John Lloyd, Jimmy Mulville, Beryl Virtue, and Paul Jackson. Essentially, they reminisce about the good old days of comedy. Nicolas Cage would like to know your take on this group of people within the context of BBC comedy and the wider world. You got any thoughts on that?
Alexis? Yes, well, no, they're all people. I mean, you know, I have a great deal of disdain for a lot of people in the comedy business, but John Lloyd, I think, although he was one of the kind of Oxford generation, along with Angus and Rowan and Mel and Griff and all those people, I think John Lloyd was a real genius, really. That he was, you know, he was the producer of Blackadder, really, and I mean many other things, but really
not the 9 o'clock news.
Not 9 o'clock news.
Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Spitting Image.
Yeah.
QI.
And he's, I think he's really, he's a very good producer. I think he didn't, you know, when he got to the second series of Blackadder, he made both Richard Curtis and Ben Elton rewrite. Neither of them are people who will do that of their own volition, but I think he forced them. He made that show a lot better than it is. Who's the second one? And I've always, he's always been very nice to me, Lloydie, but I've got great affection for him.
That's nice. Jimmy Mulville.
Jimmy Mulville was also one of that generation. Jimmy Mulville actually went to our school and he was actually head boy of also grammar school.
Oh, you went to your school?
Went to our school. And he's a couple of years below me. He's the founder of Hat Trick. But yeah, which brought us Have I Got News for You? And and I'd like to ask him why I haven't been asked to be on Have I Got News for You for 25 years. Jimmy's a complicated individual, but you know, again, he's done. I mean, he's working class. I mean, Liverpool Catholic family, quite difficult background, I think. And he, you know, he went to Oxford at the same time as Lloydie and those people. But nevertheless, he's made himself a big name in comedy, really. So he had some of those advantages because he went to Oxford. I often think, like, for a working class kid, if you go to Oxford or Cambridge, it's a sort of way that they even though you're working class, you are. The rites of passage that you go through at Oxford or Cambridge mean that you end up being anti-working class. It's a way of kind of I don't know if this sounds coherent, but it's a way of going to those two particular universities as a way of taking working class kids and making them subservient to the root, to the power elite, really. And, you know,
turning you into one of them.
Well, you are. I think you're never completely trusted, you know. But you are. They allow you a seat at the table, you know, if you go to those universities and you conform. And so, you know, I think that Jimmy went through that process as well. I mean, it's an interesting topic in itself. That whole, you know, and there's some. I mean, I've got a friend whose kid's at Cambridge, and he's. I don't think. He's not going through that particular process, but certainly in my day, that seemed to me to be what. I mean, Oxford and Cambridge's primary duty was to just reinforce the power elite, the power structures in our. Reinforce to take people from the ruling class and just to inject them, new, fresh generations into, you know, positions of power, really, which is what Oxford and Cambridge does. But then it had a secondary function, which is to take bright, intelligent, working class kids and inculcate them into the power structures as well and make them give up their allegiance to their class, you know, so kind of, you know, drop their accents and stuff like that.
Who are some of the exceptions to that?
I don't know.
Heroes of Oxford and Cambridge.
Okay. For Frank Cottrell Boyce, I suppose, is somebody who went to Oxford, but it's not really. You wouldn't call an establishment. Well, he's, I mean, wouldn't you? Wouldn't at all call an establishment figure, really. It always struck me that that was a function of Oxford and Cambridge, really. So, you know, it takes a lot of self-sacrifice. It takes a lot of intelligence for somebody like Jimmy to get to Oxford and Cambridge, and you know, I think there's a tension. I mean, it's an interesting idea. I think if you are somebody like that, a working class person who gets to Oxford or Cambridge, you know, there's always a slight sense that you're never quite one of them, you know. And that's something I went through as well. I think it was a difficult, because, you know, when I became successful, you know, most of my friends were suddenly
Sting.
A lot of them were people from Oxford and Cambridge. I write about, there's that scene in The Young Ones when we made Bambi, and Bambi. I'd pre-recorded my bit, and I just came in for the studio stuff, and I found, you know, that they'd got that Mel, and I hadn't known this, Mel Smith, Griffreys Jones, Ben Elton, Emma Thompson,
Stephen Fry,
and Hugh Laurie were all in the episode. And I said to Lisa and Rick, I said, well, I don't understand. I thought these people were the enemy. And they just said, no, that was just you. You thought they were the enemy. We think they're absolutely darling. And Stephen's made us muffins and quoting Cicero for us in the lunch break. And
they were the heels of the episode, though, you know.
Hey?
They were like the villains of the episode, these posh quacks, you know, and they get their
own. They were, that's true. But but I did find myself in that position, really, where, you know, and I've never, I did some stand-up about it, really, how you'd lose your tribe, really, and never completely find another. So Jimmy, Beryl Birchall,
but having said all that, you're still waiting for that call for
Have I got news for you? 25 years later, yeah.
Let's hope he doesn't hear this podcast. Yes, Beryl Virtue, who died 4 years ago, so this show
I thought she was dead. Yeah, because she's got a daughter. So Beryl Virtue was, I don't know, but a lot of people loved her, really. She was a comedy producer, and so obviously this is, it's Radio 4, isn't it? So it's a lot of archive stuff.
Yeah.
And Paul Jackson, me and Paul Jackson and Lisa Mayer will be doing an event in Morecambe somewhere. I think, are you involved in that? I can't remember.
No, which I'm confused about.
Yeah, well, maybe we'll get you involved.
But yes, he directed some Young Ones stuff.
He produced and directed the Young Ones. And even when Jeff Parsoner directed some of the episodes, where Paul was the producer, Paul was the moving. Paul was the one who made the Young Ones happen, essentially, really. And I'm always eternally grateful to him for that. Was it 2 years ago we did Glastonbury with Paul and Lisa? And you did the clips?
Must be 2, maybe 3.
Oh, it's 2. Paul, me and Paul and Lisa May will be appearing somewhere in Morecambe. God knows why. We're talking about the Young Ones sometime in July, I think. I'm always. And then Paul went on to do other amazing things.
Yes, he produced The Ron Clark Story.
What the hell's that?
A drama film from 2006 starring Matthew Perry from Friends. Okay, well, there you go, Nicolas Cage.
Yeah, so we got a long answer out of that.
Nikki said, it's not a question, an observation. Catching up and just listened to the Halloween D&D special. Not laughed so hard in ages. Brightened a rainy Monday. Thank you.
You're just looking for people to support your side of the street on that debate.
Bob responded, don't encourage them. Heaven forbid they might do another one.
You've got another one planned, haven't you? Another one in the works.
Yes, it's coming. Right. Do you want to hear a bit of music?
Yes.
I've had two people send me songs in the past weeks. I'll go in order because this one Alex sent to me yonks ago, in a month ago, and I should have played it then when it was a big, they were doing their launch. But forgive me, Alex. Hey, Alex Hay, composer, multi-instrumentalist and producer. Please forgive me. But this is when we've managed to get round to it. Hi, Alexi. Hi, Talal. Big fan, long-time listener. Emailing to let you know that my band, they're from Brighton, the Barstool Preachers, has just released a single called Pick a Side, calling out artists afraid to use their platform to denounce the genocide in Gaza. It's a bratty, catchy number, and we're donating all proceeds to medical aid for Palestinians. And they're running a concurrent fundraiser. Hope you listen. Hope you like it. You can buy it from their Bandcamp. But let me play you like 30 seconds of it. It's quite punky and loud. All right? So brace yourself.
Okay. All right.
In Madrid, like some bratty little kids. Cause someone put a flag of Palestine, he lost his rag. Said, don't make me pick a side. Went offline and tried to hide. Said, I'm just a singer, I'm just here to do my job. But you put yourself across like the world's biggest went to gob. And when all your songs are political, make you decide if a critic. You won't pick a side in a genocide. Don't pretend you're fine. You'll never make it.
That's the Barstool Preachers.
Yes, all right.
Pick a side. Yeah. I didn't know what to think of it at first because that intro is so kind of poppy. But then he starts talking, and I like the chorus, is really catchy. You can
Were the band who stormed off time? Was that Radiohead?
My message to the guy, I said, oh, are you referring to Radiohead or Sleaford Mods there? Tom York or Sleaford Mods? Is that what I said? Yeah, or Darren Malakian.
Sleaford Mods been
well, they kicked off. It was a couple years ago now. Someone was waving a Palestine flag at their show, and I think I might be misremembering, but he like grabbed the flag off the guy and threw it off to the side of the stage. So don't bring that stuff here. It might have been a kufiya or something. This isn't the place for that. You know, we're just here to rock out, like that kind of vibe.
Fuck yeah.
But he did respond to me. I started writing this when I got back from work one day after reading about the Sleaford Mods incident. I was pretty fucked off because they were my favorite band.
Of Sleaford Mods. I saw them as my bastard children, musical children.
But hold
really,
on.
I'm sorry.
I know they have been pro-Palestine since, but in that moment they failed. So they were just trying to like keep politics out of their show. And they've since kind of gone back on that stance.
Well, Jesus, you know.
Jesus says.
Jesus welcomes back a sinner. You know, the parable of the prodigal son tells us that, you know, he that has sinned, if he repents, then Yeshua welcome him back thrice over. So we welcome you back to the fold, Sleaford Mods.
I mean.
Yay.
Welcome back. So if you want to go and buy that single and the profits go to medical aid for Palestinians, go to thebarstoolpreachers.bandcamp.com and the song is called Pick a Side. Also check them out. They're a cool band. Actually, I've clicked around their stuff and they're very, very cool. All right, track number two.
Yes.
Is like the opposite, isn't it? I played you a little bit of this earlier.
Yeah.
Dear Alexi and Talal, solidarity, comrades. This is from the Banner Theatre. Sash at the Banner Theatre. We were hoping you might give a mention on your show in support of the Birmingham bin strikers, one of the most important worker disputes in the UK today. You're both, of course, welcome to do a dance combined with Marx's theory to this song on your social media. They're offering an interview with Banner Theatre if we're interested to talk to them about the Birmingham bin strikers. Now, this is news to me, so forgive me for not being on the pulse there, comrade. It's a protest single backing the Birmingham bin strikers 1 year on. Power to the bin strikers, Unite for Workers' Rights by Banner Theatre, released in partnership with Unite for a Workers' Economy and Unite the Union. It raises funds for Birmingham refuse workers who are refusing to work. As strike enters its second year. That's a long fucking strike, man.
Yeah.
Satirical anthem lampooning politicians and council proposals to reduce workers' pay by $8,000 per year. Oh my God. If anyone deserves more pay, it's the fucking guys who handle our rubbish. Revives the tradition of picket line songs for a new generation of strikers. It's coming out 6th of March. Well, it's come out on all major music platforms. The song is called Power to the Bin Strikers, Unite for Workers' Rights. Catchy title there. It's a rework of the 1960s hit My Old Man's a Dustman by Lonnie Donegan. An apt song, I suppose. Do you want to hear a bit of it?
Yes, very much.
Okay, here we go. Hey!
Support the Brummie bin workers, they are out on strike. This bloody Labour council are looking for a fight. They want to cut 8,000 quid from off their basic pay. That's why they're on the picket line and they are gonna stay. Power to the bin workers, power to unite. Power and solidarity, they gotta win this strike. The government commissioners on £1,000 a day. Take orders from the ministers, you gonna cut their pay. While Rayner fiddles £40,000, just a small mistake. They say we can't afford it, give us all a break. Power to the bin workers.
Okay, we get the idea there.
Yes. Well, yes, campaigning music.
Yes, I was expecting it to be more hilarious, but it's a strong message. Does its job, and it's very clear message.
Yes.
So,
but power to the bin workers.
Absolutely.
Power to. It prompted me to think. Years ago, I had a friend called Cat Ledger, who's dead now, literary agent, who was. For some reason, it was John Peel's literary agent. She arranged just to have lunch with John Peel at a Greek restaurant on Charlotte Street. And okay. Griffries Jones, she had an office in Talkback. Griffries Jones, I mean, came along as well.
Okay.
And he was a chatty fellow, to say the least, Griff. And I'd spent time with John Peel before, so. But all John Peel and Griffries Jones talked about, to the exclusion of everybody else, was Lonnie Donegan. They talked the whole lunch through about Lonnie Donegan, and I never got a look in.
Hmm.
And that was, I don't know if that's the last time I saw John Peel alive, but it was spent listening to him and Griffries Jones talk about Lonnie Donegan. Make of that what you will, people. It's just a thing that happened to me.
How do you support the binmen and buy this song? Well, you just do it. There's not a specific place. Look, it's on all the platforms. If you buy your music on iTunes, Bandcamp, Spotify, Amazon Music, YouTube, Cobuzz, Deezer, Tidal, you can find Banner Theatre's Power to the Bin Strikers, Unite for Workers' Rights. Thank you for sending in that music, guys. Send in anything you want, listeners, to alexisalepodcast@gmail.com. It's better than all that AI schlock I get sent all the time, trying to ask us if we want like the most Zionistic people on as guests. We think they'd be a great fit for your show.
Be weird if we said yes.
They support the murder of children.
Yeah.
We think they'd be a great fit for your lovely show.
Ha.
Yes. Fuck off. Strait of Hormuz. It's not straight at all. Goes up and then down. It looks like an elbow. Alexei.
All right.
Do you got anything else you want to talk about?
No, no. Big announcement soon about my book, but that'll be in a week or two.
Love you, listeners. Free Palestine.
Free Palestine, indeed.
Stop the war. No more Hiroshimas.
No.
Free, ban the bomb. Free the nipple. That's more that, that's me.
All right. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Alexei Sale podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexiselpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.